آله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين أما بعد فقد قال الله الحكيم في كتابه المتين بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم ولقد كان لكم في رسول الله أسوة حسنة. The seerah of the Prophet is the subject, and if you remember last time we were discussing about the early companions of the Prophet and the persecution and tortures that they had gone through. Here we see that the mode of command and the way the Prophet had ordained for the companions who were being persecuted is something that we can learn from and we can implement in our lives. When we looked at the people who had accepted Islam in the early days, you see that the people who accepted Islam were not weak, were not handicapped. In fact, the people who had accepted Islam were young and strong. When you have people who are young and strong, when you have individuals who are young and strong, so obviously they can defend themselves and they can fight back. If you look at those people, especially for example a lot of the people who did accept Islam were slaves, and slaves were known to be young and strong, and so they had the ability to fight back and defend themselves. But as they were being persecuted, and I mentioned the incident of Khabbab and how he was tortured, and there are many incidents like that when we go through it. One of the signs of those people who had accepted then was that the fact that they were young and they were strong also. For example, there was a person by the name of Abu Faqih. Abu Faqih was one of the early companions of the Prophet. He was a slave who became Muslim. And his master was Umayyah. And Umayyah, who was his master, when you looked at him, when Abu Faqih became Muslim, then you see that he was a strong person. He was known in Makkah as one of the strongest young men, meaning that he could wrestle anyone. He was that strong. Umayyah was, a weaker person than he is. And his father, Safwan, both of them, when this Abu Faqih became Muslim, began to torture him. And they would put him on the sand of the desert, and they would put in this huge boulder on top of him. Right? And they would ask him to forego his faith and to return to the idol worship. Now, Abu Faqih, being one of the strongest men in Makkah, right, he could have easily handled these two people. These two people who are torturing him, he could have easily handled them. Without a doubt, he could have beaten them up. He was able to defend himself, he was strong. But I want you to understand, my friends, that at the beginning of the Prophet's message and movement and mission, the Prophet had one clear order and command for everyone who became Muslim. One command. Other than the worship and learning and other things, there was one command that he had. And that was that no matter what you have to go through because of your Islam, no matter what tortures you have to face because of your faith, no matter what hardship you have to go through, you cannot do anything in response to that. Meaning at the beginning of Islam, you see there was a strict order for every Muslim to be non-violent. There was a strict order, no matter what you go through, you cannot do anything in return. Let them do what they want, you will not do anything in return. And it's because of this command of the Prophet that strong men like Khabbab and Abu Faqih were bearing these tortures. Otherwise, for anyone, if you had to go through such tortures right away, you would say that, hey, wait a minute, you know, I can fight back. But you see, at the beginning of the mission, you see there was a strict order that no one would fight back, no one would do anything. Even though, if you just pay attention here, then you will see, even though when you look at it in reality, without even Islam being in the picture, if someone wants to harm you, if someone wants to torture you, is it a natural right or not to defend yourself? Don't you have the natural right to defend yourself that, listen, you know, if you are going to harm me, I have the right to defend myself. I have the right at least to try to stop this. But you have the natural right. It is a right to defend yourself. No one would say no. It's logical, it's rational, and it's instinctive. That if you are going to be tortured, you have the right to defend yourself. But you see, the Prophet, by saying this and by making this command, that even though it's your natural right, you do not implement that right if you are going to be a part of this movement. I mean, imagine what the Prophet is asking the people to do. He's saying, even though it's your right to defend yourself, no, do not fight back. Do not do anything. Do not do anything to harm those who are torturing you. Do not do anything. I mean, understand this. And this, from here, we can understand an ideology that the Prophet has taught us. And that is, when the movement, when the mission and the message is new and people do not know about it and they're ignorant about it, then even though defending yourself is a natural right, but by doing that, the message would get the wrong image in the eyes of the people who are ignorant about it. Now from here we can understand many things that we can implement in our own lives. We see that if you have a right, if you have a right that is either a natural right or a legal right, when the message is new and the movement is new, Islam is very clear that even though it is your right to defend yourself, do not do anything, because by doing something, the image of Islam is going to be destroyed in the eyes of the ignorant people. Because the Prophet knew that if any one of the Muslims did anything to defend himself, then they will be accused of violence. They would be accused of violence. And that's the reason, you see, the Prophet made it clear to everyone that no matter what tortures you're going through, you are not going to do anything against those who are torturing you. That's why if you look at the companions and the faith that they had in the Prophet, that they went through those hardships, they went through those tortures, and they could fight back. They were strong enough to fight back. They were able to fight back, but they didn't. Why? Because the Prophet said, this is the way of Islam. Islam is new. If you do something, then there's no one who will be able to explain it to the people. They can construe your actions in any way that they want. Why? Because the media is in their hands. The media is in their hands. So even though it's your right, either your natural right or your legal right, but still you cannot use it if you are being persecuted because of your faith. And this is where you see the prophets is trying to teach us what is the ideology that we should have. Because we are living in a similar circumstance where people are ignorant of Islam, and hence what we do and whatever action we take is going to be spinned by them in any direction that they want to. Now how are you going to explain it to the people? What did you do was, you know, you're right and so on and so forth. I mean, what media you have, the member of Madinatul Ilm? Is this your media? Right? How many people is it reaching? How many people come to ourmasjid.org? Right? And see what these people are saying. So understand this, how the Prophet has taught us. Right? No matter what happens because of your faith, no matter what you have to go through because of your faith, he's saying be patient. Be patient and take it. Why? Because your actions will not be understood by the people or will be misconstrued by the people. But when they are doing what they are doing, at least they will realize how wrong they are. I mean, a time comes when a person, when he is torturing someone and doing wrong to someone, there is that guilty conscience in him that is going to make him realize that, wait a minute, there's something wrong here. Right? Am I really doing something right or is this wrong? You see, let them realize that they have made a mistake and they were wrong. But the minute you start doing something, then you see that those people or whoever wants to look at you in the wrong way, and because they have the media in their hands, they can say anything they want, and you know what? You have no way to defend yourself. You have no way to defend yourself, or at least let the truth be known. And hence, in these type of situations, until the message is not established, until it is not understood what we stand for, then the time for right now is patience, no matter what cruelty is being put upon you. No matter what tortures you're going through. And you see, this is one sign of those who are Muslims then. And the next sign of a Muslim, in the time, the early days of the Prophet, if you look at it, right, and if you see, is that the Prophet, the people who accepted Islam, the people who accepted the message of the Prophet, were not from one group of people. Even in the early days when they were a handful, when there were only a handful who accepted against all odds, they were not from one group of people. I mean, you had, for example, Arabs who accepted, you had Africans who accepted, you had Europeans who accepted. In the first 100 people, I'm saying. In the first 100 people. And then you're wondering, you know, I mean, what's going on? For example, Ammar Yasser, his example is well known. You know, he accepted Islam, his brother accepted Islam, and his mother and father accepted Islam. The whole family. And they were from Yemen. When they came to Mecca, they were given refuge by one of the influential tribes of Mecca. And unfortunately, the head of the tribe was Abu Jahl. And since Abu Jahl was the head of the tribe and he was an adamant enemy of the Prophet and Islam, so when Ammar and his family became Muslim, right away he went, because it was his job now, being the head of the tribe, to torture them, to persecute them, to make them give up their faith. And hence you see that he used to torture them. He used to put them in, for example, an iron coat and would make them sleep on the sand in the day. Right? And they would be sleeping on the sand in the day. And you know, when you wear an iron coat in heat, it sticks to your skin. And then when they would take out the coat, the skin would peel off with it. Right? This is the whole family of Ammar was going through this. Right? The whole family of Ammar was going through this. And you know what? When the Prophet used to come around there, they would intensify their torture to let the Prophet see this so that, you know, he can see what's happening to his people. Right? One day when Abu Jahl was ritually torturing Ammar and his family, he took the father of Ammar, Yasir, he took him, and there was a ditch that had fire inside it, and he took him close to the fire that he was being burned by it. And Ammar and his knee, you know, you see this again. Ammar is a young man and a strong man. He's seeing his parents going through this. Now, if he wants, he can defend it. He can go and fight them. He and his brother, both of them are young men, strong men. They can go and fight them. But you see the command of the Prophet. Right? That's coming in the between. They're looking at the torture that are going on, but they're not doing anything. They're not doing anything. And a time came when this was happening and they saw the Prophet there. They looked at the Prophet, and Ammar, he looked at the Prophet and said, you know, I mean, looking at him to see if you allow me to stop this. He could stop this. And the only thing the Prophet said, Sabran ya Ali Yasir. Be patient, O children of Yasir. Be patient. Right? They didn't do anything. The father was killed in front of them, and the mother was killed in front of them. And the children watched this, and they could defend it. They could go there and defend it, but you see that they were told, be patient. My friends, if you can just try to fathom what that means, what kind of obedience they had, then you can appreciate. You know, here we see that if someone, you know, looks at us in the wrong way, we are in their face. We have no faith. It looks at us the wrong way, we have, you know, that's it. We lose our faith, iman and everything. And we're ready to fight. The Prophet didn't have these type of people. Right? Yeah. And then you wonder, you know, why we are not making a progress. Right? You know, why we are not, why this message is not moving forward to the extent that it should and that it had in the time of the Prophet. It's because of this lack of obedience. Right? When the Prophet said non-violence, when he said patience, when he said take whatever they're giving you and do not react back. It takes a lot, right? To stand under torture, to see your mother and father being killed and not do anything regarding it. Not doing anything about it. This takes a lot, my friends. Right? This is why when we look back, we see that is the obedience that is needed. That is the understanding that is needed. That we cannot do anything in return. This is going to have the conquer. And this is an example I'm giving you. And the first 2 years after the declaration of the message, the torture was at its most intense. Right? The first 2 years, the torture was at its most intense. You know, it became so intense that there are two incidents where Muslims broke down under the torture. The first person to break down was Ammar. He was the first person to break down. He was being waterboarded.
Wow.
And he was being waterboarded, that he was being put in the water, his head in the water until he was almost dead, and he was being brought back up again. And then Abu Jahl will tell him that, you know, say, you know, that, you know, Hubal is your God.
Hubal is your God.
Yeah. Right? So, as he was going through this, my friend, understand this. It became so intense on him that he, one of those times when he was asked and he was almost dying, and Abu Jahl asked him, right, accept the idols as your God, or he said, to reject Islam. So one of those times, Ammar rejected Islam. Ammar rejected Islam, and Abu Jahl became happy and he let him go. He became happy. He said, alright, that's good. He let him go. You know? And Ammar was so upset at himself that he came to the Prophet. He came to the Prophet and he asked him that this is what happened. You know, what should I do? So, now you see, in those intense tortures, you see, now Allah sent a revelation just for Ammar. Just for Ammar to explain this. And he says, Man kafara billahi min ba'de imanihi. Anyone who rejects or who becomes a kafir after accepting Islam, then Allah is going to give him the most grievous punishment. He's going to give him the most grievous punishment. If you accept Islam and then became a kafir, Allah will give you the grievous punishment, except if you're forced to do so. Except if you're forced to do so. In that case, Allah knows what is in your heart. And hence you see that one incident where a companion of the Prophet broke down. You see, Allah is relieving him and letting him know that because you were forced to do so, there is nothing on you. If you had to go through those tortures, and if you said that, listen, alright, you know, then it's alright. You see, this is how Allah is helping the believers by revealing this ayat and letting them know that you're still okay. Allah knows that you have faith. And Khabbab also, he was the second example. Khabbab, that I mentioned the last time, he was being, his head was being burned by iron rods. You see that he came one time to the Prophet, and he didn't say that, you know, this and that. I mean, he was tortured, he was going through so much cruelty, but he came to the Prophet and he said that, just one question. He said, how long do I have to bear this? You know, how long? Now, he didn't say, you know, that, you know, I don't want to do it anymore. He said, how long is this going to go on? Right? And then Allah revealed the verse for him. He says, وَمَنْ جَاهَدَ فَإِنَّمَا يُجَاهِدُ لِنَّفْسِهِ. He says, anyone who's doing jihad, he's doing jihad for his own self. For his own self. إِنَّ اللَّهَ لَغَنِيٌّ عَنِ الْعَالَمِينَ. Allah does not need anyone in this universe. If you're being tortured for your faith, then it is for your own good that you're doing this, for your own self. It's not helping Allah in any way. It's not making him stronger, it's not making him weaker. Allah is letting him know this. He says, you know that this is something that you're doing for yourself, for your own rewards, for your akhirat, for your heaven. That's what you're doing this for. So on one hand you see this, and then the sign of the believers, as I said, right, you had people from all backgrounds. All backgrounds, they came there. And I'll mention this at the end of the speech. Right? But when all these tortures that are going on, with all the intense cruelty that's going on, when we looked at the Prophet, you know, you see, the Kufar of Makkah, the Quraysh, the chiefs of Makkah, were able to get to all the slaves, all the companions, but they were not able to do anything to the Prophet. They weren't able to do anything to the Prophet because the Prophet belonged to Bani Hashim. His uncle was Abu Talib, who was protecting him, and hence no one can touch him. No one can do anything to him. And when we looked at him, what was he doing? When all the companions are going through this hardship, what was he doing? Every day, every morning, he would come to the Kaaba and he would stay there. And anyone who enters Makkah, because everyone who enters Makkah, they come straight to the Kaaba first. Anyone who enters Makkah, you see the Prophet would be preaching to them Islam. Anyone who comes from no matter where it is, he would be behind them. He said, let me tell you something. قُلُوا لَا إِلَهَا إِلَّا اللَّهُ تُفْلِحُوا. He said, this is ignorance, what is happening. These idols are not worshipped. Right? Everyone that he meets, he is telling them. While the companions are going through the tortures, there you see the Prophet doing this. And not just there in Makkah. You know, I hinted this before in the earlier speeches, that there were certain fairs that used to happen on a yearly basis, annual fairs that used to happen in the area of Hijaz. Three of them were well known. One that happened in the month of Shawwal, another that happened in the month of Zilqad, and the third that happened in the month of Zilhajj. One of the fairs that happened in the month of Shawwal was called Ukaz. It was in a place called Ukaz. And if you remember the earlier speeches, this is the fair where Hashim, the great grandfather of the Prophet, met his wife. Right? Yeah, this was that fair. And this was a big fair that used to happen. And after that, there would be a small fair, right? Where, for example, this would be in what is now known as Wadi Fatima. And this is a small fair that used to happen. And a lot of people used to go there. And then after that, there in Zilhajj, there would be a big fair again, which was known as Zilmajaz. And people used to come to that fair. And most people who wanted to make Hajj would come to the fair of Zilmajaz, and they will go to Hajj right from there. Right? And it was known that anyone who wants to go to Hajj would come to the fair of Zilmajaz. They would spend their time at the fair. And this was the places where, for example, all the tribes used to come. Their representatives used to come. Any problems they had, any deals they want to make, anything would be done in these fairs. This was the place of meeting. This was the place of gathering. Everyone would be there. Now what happened is that when all the people, they came, all these fairs that used to happen, the Prophet used to go to each one of them. And he would go there and he would start preaching to everyone who comes there about Islam. The freedom that he had was because of Abu Talib. And he was using that freedom to make sure that he gets the message out. And he did not even waste a second in getting the message out to the people. He was going from one fair to the other. In one riwayat, it is said a person who later on became Muslim, he said that, I saw a man who in the early mornings would come to the tents of the people. Because they had tents there, everyone would have their own tents. And he would come to the tents and he would call them and he would preach to them. And I wondered who this person is, so I went behind him. I went behind him to see what he's saying. And there are four things that he was saying. Right? That's the only message he had. Only four things. He said, قُلُوا لَا إِلَهَا إِلَّا اللَّهُ تُفْلِحُوا. Say, there is no God but Allah and you will be successful. You will rule over the Arabs. The Ajam are going to follow you. And the blessings of heaven will be for you. Just four messages, just this thing. Just four things. And then you go on from one person to another. And I was following him to see what will happen. And you know what? Zuhr to Asr, right, between Zuhr to Asr was their siesta time. You know, where everyone would go to sleep. Right? I mean, everyone would go to sleep at that time. And even now, you go in the Middle East, you'll see at Zuhr time, everything closes down. And Asr, it opens up again. And everyone is sleeping. That's it. You know, you don't bother anyone between that time. And the Prophet, he would say that when Dhuhr time would come, the Prophet would stop. As everyone goes to sleep, he would not preach to them. And he also let us know also, when people are resting, you don't bother them. Right? Even if it is to preach to them Islam. Even if it is to give the message of Islam to them. When it is the time for rest, that's when you don't go to them. And there I saw the Prophet, he sat down. He was tired because the whole day he went from one tent to another. And a girl came up to him and gave him a glass of milk. A girl, and she was the niece of Khadija by the name of Zainab, who the other Muslims say, you know, that she was one of the daughters of the Prophet. Right? She was young and she came up to him. I saw her give a glass of milk to him. When he drank the milk, right, before he drank the milk, he looked at her. He said, your neck is exposed. Now you need to cover your neck. I mean, even there he was preaching to his own niece about hijab. Even that, he said, before he drank the milk, he didn't want to drink them until he tells her to get your hijab proper. Right? I mean, she was a girl, a minor, and that too, only her neck was exposed. And he said, now you need to cover the neck. Now if you saw the Mu'minat and the ladies of today, who claim to be Muslim. I mean, he had to preach to his daughter, he had a fit looking at his own niece. What would happen to him when he looks at the woman of today? You know, that they have lost their hijab. Right? I don't know with what face they're going to go before the Prophet. That is up to them to decide. With what face are you going to go before the Prophet? Right? If this is his attitude. Right? So now you see, this was the Prophet. He was preaching to the people. Day and night he was preaching. And this is what made the Quraysh so upset. They said, what can we do about him? You see, they're able to stop the companions. They were torturing them. They were cruel to them. They did whatever. But what are we going to do about this man? He's not stopping. Every delegate that comes to Makkah, he's telling them about Islam. Everyone who comes to Makkah, he's speaking to them. How can we stop him? You see, they had nothing against the Prophet. They had nothing against the Prophet. They had no weapon to do anything against the Prophet except for one weapon. Except for one weapon that they used. They had one weapon that was so effective, that was so strong, that even Allah had to intervene to stop the message. And that was detrimental for the Prophet. I mean, his whole life stopped because of the weapon that they used. This weapon that they had was a person named Abdul Uzza. Abdul Uzza was one weapon who made the life of the Prophet a living hell. He is better known as Abu Lahab. Right? He's better known as Abu Lahab. And this was one weapon that the Quraysh had against the Prophet. Abu Lahab was the uncle of the Prophet, the son of Abdul Muttalib. Abu Lahab, his nickname is Abu Lahab because Lahab means flame. And he was named that because he was very fair-skinned and handsome. He was known as the most handsome man in Arabia. People would admire his looks because he was so handsome. This is Abu Lahab. Right? And he was the uncle of the Prophet, and he was married to Umme Jamil, Umme Jamil was the sister of Abu Sufyan, the aunt of Muawiyah. Right? Umme Jamil. Now Umme Jamil obviously was also beautiful, right? And Abu Lahab was handsome. Right? And this was like, for example, the perfect, what do you call, match they had with each other. They had everything in dunya, the good looks, all the style and everything they had. Right? Now Abu Lahab, he was effective to hurt the mission of the Prophet, because Abu Lahab was one, the uncle of the Prophet. And because he was the uncle, if he says anything, no one would interfere, because he's the uncle. If your own uncle is saying these things. And he was also the neighbor of the Prophet, meaning his house was right next to the house of the Prophet. It was right next to the house of the Prophet. So on one hand you had Abu Lahab, because all the sons of Abdul Muttalib, they all lived on one street. Their all homes were next to one another. And the house of the Prophet, which was Abdullah's house, was there. Right next to it was the house of Abu Lahab. Right behind it was the house of Abu Talib. Right behind it. So this was an advantage for Abu Lahab, because he was his neighbor. And in those days, the only thing that is separating his house from Abu Lahab's house was a small wall. A small wall in between. Now, because of these reasons, now you see Abu Lahab, how did he hurt the Prophet? Let me explain that if you send me a salawat.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
My friend, understand this, how Abu Lahab made the life of the Prophet a living hell. He was his neighbor, so every day he would take his refuse, his feces, and he would throw it in the house of the Prophet. He would have a target practice to see where it goes. Right? And every day, the Prophet and his family would have to clean up that mess. Right? Right? They would have to clean up that mess. And every day, now the thing is that the home of the Prophet, was such, and in those days they used to cook the food outside, because inside, the smoke would make the room. They would cook the food outside. Every time they used to leave the lid open, they would put the refuse in the food. Right? They would put the refuse and the garbage in the food, so they can't eat the food now. Right? They had to throw away the food. And this was Abu Lahab and his wife, Umm Jamil. In those days, the wives used to go and look for the wood in the outskirts. They would go outside to look for the wood, because the wood was used for the stove. In those days they didn't have gas and these type of things. So in those days it was wood that was needed, and the woman would do this job. They would go out and get the wood. And she would make sure that she finds wood which has thorns in them. Thorns. And she would lay the thorns in front of the door of the Prophet. And every morning the Prophet would leave his house, for the morning prayer, because in those days only the morning prayer and the Maghrib prayer was wajib. So when he would leave his house for the morning prayer in order to go to the Kaaba, you see that his feet would be injured by the thorns. Right, every day. And Abu Lahab, whenever the Prophet would go out preaching, now as soon as he would preach to someone, Abu Lahab would be right behind him and say, "Don't listen to him, he's my nephew, he's a little bit crazy. He's a little bit crazy, don't listen to him." Prophet would go ahead and he would go behind him. It was like, for example, Prophet would do the preaching and Abu Lahab would come and undo the preaching. Right? He was like an advertisement that, it's coming, a commercial break, it's coming. The Prophet gave the message, then you see the commercial. Abu Lahab. he would be coming like that. And you see, he would be coming like that. And now you imagine, the Prophet is trying to give the message of Allah. Abu Lahab is right behind him. Imagine that message also now is being watered down. No one is listening because they say, well, this is your uncle is saying this. You know, your uncle is saying you're this. Your uncle is saying you're this. Understand this. This, my friends, is the way how Abu Lahab had made the life of the Prophet a living hell. And then he had two sons by the name of Atba and Utaiba. Both of them were married to the nieces of Khadija, right? Who are known as the daughters of the Prophet because they were raised in his house. Right? And both of them were married to Abu Lahab's children, his two sons. Right? And now to make matters worse, he told his sons, go and divorce your wife and take them to the house of the Prophet and drop them off there. So the two sons came with the wife and they said, here are your our wives, we divorced them, that's it, we have nothing to do with them. And the Prophet said, you know, I mean, these are your wives, I mean, why are you doing this and that? So Atba, you know, he got upset at the Prophet, or, you know, like he was trying to, you know, make him, because, you know, like, it's his wife and he can do what he wants with it, you know. So, you know, what happened is that whenever you have a wife, you always have an upper hand against her father. And so he said, you know, no, I don't want her, you know. And they made excuses, you know, she's whatever, you know, this and that. And so when the Prophet was trying to explain to them, Atba spit on the Prophet's face. Right? He spit on the Prophet's face, but one of the miracles of the Prophet is that anyone who tries to humiliate the Prophet, the humiliation never reaches him. And so the spit also never reached his face, it went away somewhere else. Right? But the intention was there. Right? So now what happened is that when that happened, you see that the Messenger of Allah right away said that may Allah overwhelm you with a ferocious animal. You know? And that's all he needed to say. Now, you see, Abu Lahab, they are rejecting the message of the Prophet, but now that he said this, now they're taking this seriously. You see, now Abu Lahab will not let go of his son anywhere. He said, you can't go out. Why? Because the, you know, because he said, you're going to be eaten by an animal. You see, they are rejecting Islam openly, but they know that the Prophet is truthful and he never lies. You see, they know that the Prophet is truthful and he never lies. And just this statement has now changed their whole life. Their whole life is changed by this one statement. And that one statement that he made, now you see, his whole life is changed and he's protecting his son. Atba, you will not go out anywhere, this and that. A year later, they had to go on a trip. Why? To do business. So his dad, Abu Lahab, went with Atba. He said, I'm going to be with you all the time. They came to a stop. When they come to a stop, he made sure that they made a wall around where Atba is sleeping and that he would be there next to him. And he slept with him. And it so happened that a lion jumped over the camel and he did strike the neck of Atba and ate his neck. Salawat alaikum. Now if I was Abu Lahab, I would have stopped whatever I was doing there and repented. I mean, you know, the Prophet said this and it came out true right before your eyes. You should have ended it there. You should have ended it there. But no, Abu Lahab went on. And now, you know, his animosity came to an extent that when the son of the Prophet, right, when he died, and the Prophet had no children now, when his son died, he was newly born and he died. When he died, then he came, you know, and the news, obviously he's a neighbor of the Prophet, you know, everyone starts crying in the house and this and that. He's like, what's going on there, you know? Or the son died. When he heard the son died, he started to shout with laughter. He shouted, shout with laughter, and he came out clapping his hands, and he came all the way to the Kaaba where the chiefs were there. And he was clapping there and he said, listen, They're asking, why are you so happy? Why are you clapping for? He said, the son of Muhammad is dead and now he is up there and has no lineage and no children. Right? He has no lineage, no children, he's up there now. They looked at him with disgust. They looked at him with disgust. I said, leave alone Islamic standards, right? Leave alone Islamic standards. There are certain standards that dunya also sets. Dunya also has some akhlaq. It's not like dunya is without akhlaq, you know? Dunya also has certain moral standards. My friends, understand this. A person who doesn't obey Allah's standards, okay, it's one thing. You know, let me give you an example. If a woman doesn't wear hijab, it's one thing. Right? But dunya also has a standard. You know, and they're not like, you know, they also have certain moral values. They said, listen, no matter what, wear some clothes, you can't go out naked. You know, I mean, that's the standard of dunya. otherwise you will be like animals. Right? You go out naked, we'll be animals. You know, so dunya also has standard. Someone who even crosses the limits of dunya, that dunya has set, then really, even the people of dunya start to look at that person with disgust. Even the people of dunya who are kuffar, who have no moral values, but they will look at a person like that with disgust. They'll say, man, look at this, you're so low. Now you see, this person, at least, you know, over there, they had certain standards. That one of the standards they had, dunya standards, a worldly standard. What was that? That if someone belongs to your family, you do not defame him in the public. Meaning you don't bring your home laundry outside, right, for everyone to see. I mean, here, your nephew lost his son and you are clapping and you're congratulating everyone else. This is your nephew, man. You see, if you have no regard for Islamic law or morals, at least there are certain rules we have amongst the Jahil Arabs. If you don't even put them in respect, then really you must be someone who's so low that you have no excuse with. This is that Abu Lahab, my friends. And now what happened to him, inshallah, next time I'll explain. But all here, what I need for you to know is this. When he came out and said that he's up there, imagine the effect on the Prophet's family. The Prophet, he has ilmul ghaib, he knows, he has wisdom, he has the knowledge of Allah, he is patient, more than patient, he's thankful to Allah. Right? But then the people, everyone is looking at Muhammad and saying, this is a curse from Allah. Meaning this is the curse from Hubal and from all the guards of the Kaaba that he lost his son. He has no sons anymore. This is a curse. That's what happens when you oppose our guards. See, that's what happens when you oppose our guards. You see, now the way it's being said. Anything, my friends, this happens all the time. And understand this is ideology that we're learning. Right? That, you see, ignorant people will use situations to spin that situation in their favor. And this is here, the Prophet lost his son, so they are saying, this is the curse from Hubal. Because he curses Hubal now, Hubal has cursed him. This is why you see, that when that situation came in the house of the Prophet, such a low situation, that's why you see, that when Fatima was born, in that dim situation, in that grim situation where everyone was pointing fingers at the Prophet, in that situation when Fatima was born, imagine what sort of happiness was brought in the house of the Prophet. She was born, then you see what sort of happiness was there. That the house of the Prophet and Khadija, and everyone is against them. And now you see, this daughter is born. Now you understand what was the role of Fatima now. Allah, He says about Ahlul Bayt, إِنَّمَا يُرِيدُ اللَّهُ لِيُذْهِبَ عَنْكُمُ الرِّجْسَ أَهْلَ الْبَيْتِ وَيُطَهِّرَكُمْ تَطْهِيرًا.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
That Allah only intends to purify, to take away all impurities from you, O Ahlul Bayt. By O Ahlul Bayt, Allah wants to take all the impurities away from you and give you a thorough cleansing. So if Allah is cleansing someone, then obviously he cannot get dirty. I mean, you know, for example, you go to the dry cleaner, if he messes up, you can blame the dry cleaner, you know, you didn't do a good job. Allah is saying that if he's going to clean someone, then after that, no one can say that there's dirt on him. Right? Is there not? Allah has made it. He said, this is what I'm going to do. If I'm cleaning Ahlul Bayt, then there is no dirt on them. My friends, understand this, you know. This ayat did not come for the Prophet. This ayat did not come for the Prophet. This ayat did not come for Imam Ali. This ayat did not come for Imam Hussain and Imam Hassan. And surely it didn't come for the wives of the Prophet. Right? This ayat didn't come for any one of them. Right? It didn't come for Imam Ali. Those who say Ahlul Bayt, they say, oh, Imam Ali is included in this, Imam Hassan is included in this, Imam Hussain is included, who are the Ahlul Bayt? It didn't come for them. Allah is trying to prove the infallibility of someone. There are two ways in which Allah proves the infallibility of someone. Two ways that He proves it. The first way of proving the infallibility of someone is if Allah appoints him to a position of a prophet or an imam. If Allah appointed someone as a prophet, then he has to be infallible. He has to be infallible. If he is not, if he's making mistakes, then his mistakes would become Islam. Simple as that. His mistakes, if he appointed a prophet, you know, let's say I came to this people, you know, Allah appointed me. I came to these people. I see these are Muslims. And, you know, so I say, alright, we are Muslims, this and that, you know, so the time for Dhuhr comes and let's play Dhuhr. We all say, what do you mean Dhuhr? What's Dhuhr? Salat, let's pray Salat, you know. He said, what's Salat? Are you all Muslims? Yes. Are you all believe in Allah? Yes. Prophet? Yes. Well, then we have to pray. So what do we pray? So you don't know what prayer is? No. No one taught us that. I said, alright, you know. Now let me explain it to you. We need to pray. We are Muslims. Right? I said, alright, okay. How do you pray? He said, okay, just do like what I do. So I say Allahu Akbar, and they all say Allahu Akbar behind me. You all say Allahu Akbar behind me. Then I start reading Alhamd, so you all start reading Alhamd. I read the other chapter, you read the other chapter. Then I say Allahu Akbar and go straight into Sajda. And you all will go straight into Sajda. And then again we stand up, we do the same thing. Right? We did it. Alhamdulillah. We prayed. So now you learn how to pray. Right? And now every time you pray, you say Alhamd, and the other chapter, you say Allahu Akbar, go straight into Sajda. And everyone starts to pray like that because that's how they learn it. Right? Now, obviously, one of you goes on a journey and goes to another Muslim place, and there you meet someone who's a little bit more knowledgeable than I am. Right? And you start praying there, and he looks at you praying, and he sees you going straight into Sajda. He says, what are you doing? He says, I'm praying. He says, well, what about ruku? What about ruku? Aren't you going to do ruku? What do you mean ruku? What's that? You know? You have to do ruku. Then Sajda. No, we have been taught this way. But wait a minute. This is the right way of prayers. You see, I made the mistake. Everyone is following my mistake. Someone else comes and then he's going to say, no, this is a mistake. You do it this way. My friends, understand this. When this happens, when this is the case, now you understand that someone, if I make a mistake, then there are other ulama who can correct my mistake, who can rectify my mistake. But if I am the only one and no one else is there, then my mistake will remain as Islam forever. And this is the last prophet you're talking about. If one prophet comes, if he makes a mistake, then that mistake will become Islam. Then Allah is asking us to obey a mistake and error. How can Allah ask us to obey error and mistakes? So if He sends someone as a prophet or an imam, it means that he has to be infallible. He cannot make mistakes. If he makes mistakes, then that mistake would be Islam then. That mistake would be Islam. And hence the first way of Allah letting others know that someone is infallible is if He appoints them. The second way is that if He announces it in the Quran. If He reveals it. See, understand this. This is the reason. When Allah sent the Prophet, by making him a prophet, we know that he's infallible. There's no need for a revelation. When Imam Ali is an imam, then just because he's an imam, we know he's infallible. There's no need for a revelation. If Imam Hassan is an imam, then there's no need for a revelation. If Imam Hussein is an imam, there's no need for a revelation to Allah, for us, to let us know that he's infallible. Just by being an imam, he's infallible. And hence, why this ayat al-tathir came then? What was the reason for ayat al-tathir? Ayat al-tathir did not come for the Prophet or Imam Ali or Imam Hassan or Imam Hussein. Ayat al-tathir came to prove that Fatima is masoom.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
Nare Haydari.
Fatima's infallibility is proved through this. Fatima needed, Allah needed to prove that she is all right because she is not an imam, nor is she a prophet.
Yeah.
So how do you prove the ismat of someone who is neither prophet nor imam or not, has no post? So Allah has to say it to the people, look, she's infallible. Right? She's infallible. And that's why she, Allah made her infallible. And why didn't He make her an imam? If He had made her an imam, it would be easy. You know, then you'd have a woman imam also. Right? But you see, He didn't make her an imam. He didn't make her a prophet. Right? In short, I just want to say this so that you know why. Why didn't He make her an imam? Why didn't He make her a prophet? The issue with our prophet and our imams was not their personality. Everyone liked the prophet. Abu Lahab loved the prophet. When he was born, he used to love him so much. He showered his love on him. Right? Everyone loved the Prophet. They all said he is honest and trustworthy. They all liked him. Everyone liked Imam Ali. They said he's a good man, he's a knowledgeable person and everything. The problem they had was not with Muhammad, they had a problem with prophethood. They had a problem. Don't say you're a messenger. That's it. You know, we like you as Muhammad, Muhammad ibn Abdullah, alhamdulillah, you're good. We know you, that's it. We have a problem with you being a messenger. They didn't have a problem with Ali. They had a problem with Ali being an imam. That's what the problem was. Otherwise, they had no problem with Imam Ali. Okay, you're a good man, this and that. Fine, you know, you can stay here. But don't say you're the imam. They had a problem with him being the imam. And hence now, on one hand, the issue was prophethood on one hand, imamut on the other hand. Now if Prophet Muhammad said, I testify I'm the prophet, they'll say, okay, you're testifying for yourself. Right? If Imam Ali testified for the prophet, then we'll be like, okay, you're the successor, so obviously, you know, you'll testify. Right? So obviously you will testify, right? I mean, you're imam, you're prophet. But you see, now Allah needed a testimony for both prophethood and for both imamates. Allah needed a testimony of someone who is infallible but is neither a prophet nor an imam, so that she can, that person can come and testify for prophethood and testify for imamates. That is why when prophethood was questioned, In Mubahela, Fatima came out to defend Prophethood. When Imamat was questioned in the court of the Khalifa, she came out in the court of the Khalifa to prove Imamat. And hence, this is the reason when Ayat al-Tathir was revealed, it was noted that Fatima is the nucleus of Ahlul Bayt. Why? Because this Ayat is being revealed for her.
Yeah.
Right? When Ayat al-Tathir was revealed, what was it said? When Jibreel asked Allah, who are these people under this cloak? He said, "Hum Fatima, wa abuha, wa ba'liha, wa banuha." This is Fatima, her father, her husband, and her children. Why was Fatima mentioned? My friend, understand, why was Fatima? Because the ayat was being revealed for her. And hence Fatima's ismat and infallibility is proven in this. That state of Fatima. I mentioned this before in the shahadat of Hazrat Fatima, but just to let you know about this hadith, Qudsi. Right, one time I repeat it, you know, so we can repeat it, so we can reflect upon it. Right, Allah tells the Prophet, "Lawlaka lama khalaqtul aflak." Allah, He told the Prophet that, "Messenger, if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't have created this universe. I wouldn't have created all the stars. I mean, what is this? You know, bodies of dust and this and that have no value for me. It is your faith that has value for me. If it wasn't for your faith, I mean for your faith, I wouldn't have created all this universe." Right? And then he said to the Prophet, "Walau la Ali lama khalaqtuka." If it wasn't for Ali, I wouldn't have created you also, Muhammad. I wouldn't have created you if it wasn't for Ali. Right? Then he said after that, "Walau la Fatima lama khalaqtuma." If it wasn't for Fatima, I wouldn't have created both of you. That is the position of Fatima. Right? If one understands what her position is, then one would make her a means of intercession between himself and Allah. Make her a means of intercession between himself and Allah on the Day of Judgment. Make her the Shafi, someone who is going to be there for you. And that is why Allah gave them this position. I ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to give us the tawfiq and the blessing to be on the right path. Give us the wisdom to understand His guidance. His tender reference of our Imam. Make us His helper when He comes. Wa akhir al-da'wana alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Salamat alhamdulillah. Inshallah, we will, you know, just a few things as I wanted to make clear to you all, right? Certain things that you all need to know, inshallah. As I was mentioning in the speech, right, and I said I'll mention it at the end. If you look at the community of the Prophet that was there, if you look at the community of the Prophet, you saw a variety of people. You didn't see one group, only the Arabs or only the Africans. You saw a variety of people. You know, in your life, for example, the example of Suhaib. Right? Suhaib was one of the early people who accepted Islam. He comes from a Roman family, and you know, his history aside, you know, it happened that he was abducted, became a slave in Europe and this and that, and he ran away, came to Makkah. In Makkah he was known as Suhaib Rumi, you know, because he was blonde and blue-eyed. Right? He was blonde and blue-eyed, but he was a very good businessman. And he became wealthy in Makkah. He worked with an aristocrat in Makkah called Abdullah ibn Judan. Became a wealthy person. And he also, now you see that when he heard the message of the Prophet, he accepted it right away. Right? And because he was rich, he wasn't put through those tortures that the slaves were put through. Right? He was put under house arrest because he had his own slaves, he had his own people, you know, this and that, they couldn't do anything to him. But they put him under house arrest. When the Prophet made hijrat, when he left Makkah to go to Medina, he also wanted to go with the Prophet, but he was under house arrest. And so one day, after the Prophet left, he acted as if he had diarrhea. He told the guards, "I need to go to the bathroom." He did it once, did it twice, did it thrice. And after that, you know, the guard said, "Okay, whatever you need to go, go ahead." So he used that opportunity to run away. He ran away and he came to a place on the mountains. He hid in the mountains. When they realized that he ran, so they came after him. They came after him. Now he was also an expert archer. And so he said, he told them, "If you come any closer, I'm going to put each of these arrows in your necks, and you know I'm a good shooter." So they said, "Listen, we won't let you get away." He said, "Why don't you let me get away? You know, I don't want to stay here." He said, "Because you earned so much money in Makkah, and it's because of us you became wealthy." And he says, "Okay, you know, is that all you want?" He said, "Yes, we want your money." He says, "Go in my house, and in this room, all my money is there." When they heard that, they left. Right? They left him, they went back, they got the money. That person who worked all his life to build up wealth, build up a lot of wealth, he gave all that, and he came penniless to the Prophet. But the Prophet met him before he entered Medina. When the Prophet met him, he said to him, "Suhaib, that was the best business transaction you have done in your life. You gave up all your wealth that you earn in this dunya for the hereafter. Right? This is the best transaction you have done in your life." Right? My friends, want you know that the people, the community of the Prophet was a diverse community. They came there for the message. They came there for the faith and for the movement. And they were together because of that. And I just want you all to know that, you know, I thank Allah, right? I really thank Allah that what I see here in our community resembles the community of the Prophet. That is what I see here. Right? And there is a reason why everyone is from different backgrounds here and they're coming here. It's because of not that we belong to a certain ethnic group or certain background or certain language, but we belong to a certain ideology that we have believed in. And because of that, we see that what we have here is something that is like a treasure. It is a treasure for us. Right? And if one only knows the barriers that are making people gather together, meaning, you know, those who get together, really, they don't get together because of faith. They get together because of language, because of background, because of nationality, because of these things. There are certain priorities that have to be taken into consideration. It's an important work that needs to be done for Allah's sake. One of the things that we see in America that is right now the most important thing for us, facing us as an ummah, is the lack of ulama that we have. We don't have ulama here. We used to rely on immigrants who used to come here. Now the visas are not being given. We used to, have ulama here, and you see a lot of them are being deported for slightest reasons, not paying their taxes on time. You know, for whatever reasons, they're being detained. One of the important things that have to be done here, that has to be established here, is to establish a place of learning here in America. We cannot really know how long the doors are open to the Hausa in Iran or other places. We don't know what's going to happen. And if we are going to depend on that, and once the door closes, then now we can't even go there and learn. That is why one of the important really things right now, right, is to establish the Hausa. To make it working so that we can produce ulama here. We can have an institution of learning here. Because only through having a Hausa where you can have good teachers, because teachers become good with experience. I mean, alim who comes out of the Hausa, it's not like, for example, his knowledge is all the time good. But when he teaches, then it becomes better. He becomes stronger. We don't have strong teachers because we don't have institution of learning. We don't have students also because there's no institution of learning. And most people, they don't know how to get to, for example, the Hausa in Iran or elsewhere. You know, and really right now, if I encourage anyone to go somewhere, it would be Iran. It wouldn't be, you know, go to any place else. Right? The issue is right now, right, is that that is more of a priority. And it is for this reason, right, that the opportunity to establish a Hausa has come up in Orlando, that I'm moving to Orlando. Because of this reason. I will be coming here on Saturdays. But the Hausa is already in progress. Classes are every day. I'm the only teacher there right now, but hopefully we'll have more teachers later on as we grow. But it is more of a priority for me to be there and run the Hausa. And we are working to have the Hausa here, to bring the Hausa here, because that place is also on rent. We rent that place for $1,500 a month. But it's a 6-acre land, with 3 buildings on it, so obviously, you know, 1,500, right? It says one of our own brothers who gave it to me, you know, so that we can run the Hausa. It is a start. But if you can build a permanent home here in Tampa, then I will be back here soon, right? And moving back here soon. But it is for this reason that I'm moving to Orlando, and hopefully in the next 2 months I will be in there. I mean, I'm there already the whole week. I just come here on the weekends. But I will be moving there hopefully over the vacation. And I just wanted to explain that, you know, I wouldn't advise anyone to move to Orlando behind me, because I'm telling you, you're not going to find a community like this. Right? You will not find a community like this. Right? You will find a Desi community, you will find a Khoja community, and you will find, you know, some other community, but you will not find a community that is like this, my friends. You know, and we have done a lot to build this community, and we'll keep on building it. Right, but me not being here, meaning over the weekdays, I'll be here on the weekends, right, on Saturdays, until we can see, you know, how we can move the house right here. Because as you know, we want to buy the land next door. If we buy the land next door, we are making a plan right now. Alhamdulillah, I have certain people who have already like, for example, they have already pledged to build the whole Hausa, right? If we can make up a plan. So we want to make the plan for this place, and then when we make the plan, hopefully we will build the Hausa and a home for the Hausa here with the masjid that we will have and the center that we will have on this property. So inshallah, you know, this is our plans, and so everyone should know what is happening. You know, and we want to raise the funds, obviously, you know, like more funds at the MC, inshallah, you know, and every one of us should be there at the Muslim Congress, right? Because it's in Miami, it's close to us, we don't have to go on a long drive, even though it's exciting, right? But it's close to us, so we don't have to go that far. We should be there. We are in charge of the food, so we are trying to raise from our community $3,000, from Orlando $3,000, you know, for the food. So anyone who wants to donate towards the food that is going to be served there, inshallah, you're welcome. You have to give the money for that. Any questions now? Yes. All right then, inshallah, you know. Yes, one minute. Obviously, yes.